Most government hospitals have remained largely empty because of a nationwide strike action by resident doctors who constitute a large percentage of medical doctors in government hospitals in Nigeria. Consultancy rooms have remained empty because of the absence of medical doctors to attend to patients. Doctors' union officials said they are tired of the government failing to live up to its promises of settling their salaries and other benefits on time. Representatives of the Nigerian government met with labor leaders behind closed doors in a last-minute effort to avert the strike, but apparently the meeting ended in a deadlock. The government appealed to the doctors to consider the damage their withdrawal of services will cause to Nigeria's health system. But the resident doctors said the government should keep its several promises. This strike is coming at a challenging period, especially with the COVID-19 pandemic, with only about 800,000 Nigerians vaccinated. In a country with a population of close to 200 million. Nigeria has 163,000 COVID-19 cases, out of which 2,038 people have died so far. The doctors' union said all the resident doctors at the COVID-19 centers have joined the strike and withdrew their services. This doctor's strike is in progress just when the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is receiving treatment in a London hospital. According to union officials, close to 16,000 resident doctors are participating in this strike, which is indefinite. Most of the resident doctors are specialists who provide important healthcare services, especially in emergency wards. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, held virtual talks on Friday to discuss the fate of the agreement. During the meeting attended by China, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain, along with Iran, the signatories agreed to hold in-person talks in Vienna on Tuesday. That will be part of the meetings of the Joint Commission of the Nuclear Deal. Later, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed there will be indirect talks with Iran in Vienna.
These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA, and the sanctions relief steps the United States would need to take in order to return to compliance.
Tehran will hold no direct or indirect talks with Washington before it removes all anti-Iranian sanctions.
According to the immutable guidelines set out by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, any outcome of the joint JCPOA commission meeting, which is based on the notion of step-by-step removal of sanctions, is unacceptable. According to the guidelines by the leader, the Islamic Republic will only return to its JCPOA commitments after the removal of all US sanctions and Iran's verification of the move. The Islamic Republic will not hold any mediated or unmediated talks with the US before all sanctions are lifted. Just as the US left the 2015 nuclear deal without negotiations and imposed sanctions on Iran, it should now remove all sanctions without talks.
Iran signed into the 2015 nuclear deal and committed itself to limiting its civilian nuclear program in exchange for removal of all nuclear-related sanctions against the country. That was meant to ensure Iran benefits economically from the accord, but those benefits were scarce and fully evaporated after the former U.S. administration withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. Analysts say all Iran is saying is that a once-negotiated deal does not need to be renegotiated.
The deal was the result of negotiations. So the negotiations have already taken place. The deal tells all sides what they're supposed to do. So the Americans know exactly what they're supposed to do. There's nothing to negotiate. If they want the deal to work, they have to implement it. But if they want to take bits and pieces and think that they can gain concessions from Iran, Iran is not going to do that.
Almost 3 months into the Biden administration, Washington is yet to right Donald Trump's wrongs on the nuclear deal. Tehran is clearly seeing through Washington's empty rhetoric and is calling for action. On Friday, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told a virtual meeting on the nuclear deal that the remedial measures Iran took after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal are reversible, but only after the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions and its verification by Tehran.
Thank you. Israeli settlers have escalated their daily raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds in the last couple of days during their celebrations of one of the Jewish holidays known as Passover. On Thursday alone, hundreds of Israeli settlers raided the holy site under the protection of Israeli forces, according to the Muslim religious authorities, or what's known as the Awqaf, which administrates the compound. Palestinian officials denounced what they described as provocative moves, saying that Israel has simultaneously banned Palestinian worshippers from entering the mosque.
The Israelis are accompanied and protected by soldiers and are allowed to raid the site and desecrate it. The Israeli forces closed the markets and the shops in the old town. A number of Palestinian youths were detained. It was another occupation of the Al-Aqsa complex and the old town, but this time by the settlers along with the soldiers.
Israeli settler groups have called on their supporters to converge on the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in celebration of Passover, which began on March 27 and lasts until April 3. Thousands of Israeli soldiers were deployed across Jerusalem Al-Quds to provide a protection to settlers who toured in groups the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and took photos of several places. Other strict measures have also been taken on Friday to prevent Muslims reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Experts believe the incursions are part of Israel's policy to Judaize the holy site and expel the Palestinians out from the holy city.
The Israeli regime is escalating the situation in Jerusalem Al-Quds. It's only mounting tensions. The Israeli prime minister is facing internal problems and he's looking for ways to survive. He knows settlers will help him to do so. That is why he won't stop their acts. Therefore, the settlers are provided with a good opportunity to desecrate the site and provoke the Palestinians during their holidays.
Since its occupation of the Palestinian lands, Israel has been launching violent crackdown on Palestinians in different ways, especially when it serves Tel Aviv's interests. During the Jewish holidays, Israeli settlers escalate their raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinians say the raids are provocative and pursue the policy of suppression by Israeli regime against the Palestinian people living in the holy city of Al-Quds. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The West and Russia are on a collision course again over Ukraine. The Kremlin has warned the Western military alliance NATO that any deployment of troops along the Ukrainian border with Russia would deteriorate the situation further. Moscow says it would be forced to take extra measures to ensure its own security if the U.S.-led NATO sends troops in support of Ukraine. That, a day after the Ukrainian president accused Russia of building up troops along the border amid renewed clashes between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian militias. Russia says its military presence on the border is not meant to threaten Ukraine. Moscow's response came after the U.S. warned last week against what it called Russian intimidation and pledged to stand by Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine have had a conflict centered on Crimea and Donbas regions since 2014. Tensions surfaced with Kiev and Moscow recently trading blame for a spike in violence in eastern Ukraine. In a recent meeting, NATO ambassadors condemned what they called Moscow's military buildup near Ukraine. However, the Russia foreign minister says the U.S.-led anti-Russia NATO campaign will ultimately destroy Ukraine.
Judging by the information published by the media, the majority of Ukrainian military forces understands the fatality of any actions leading to a hot conflict. I very much hope that they will not be incited by politicians, who in turn will be incited by the West, led by the United States.
The U.S. and European leaders are losing no time to denounce and threaten Russia, citing Ukraine. Tensions have been running high ever since Ukraine's Crimea region re-entered into Russia following a referendum. Since then, NATO has been expanding its Eastern Front. The United States missile systems in Romania and Poland, as well as American soldiers and military hardware in the region, are part of the military alliance game plan. Latvia and Lithuania are among destinations where NATO members have been sending their troops and weaponries. The reason? They lie right along the border with Russia. Apart from military deployments near Russia's borders, the West has imposed several rounds of sanctions against the Kremlin. It seems the continued pressure on Russia could plunge the two sides into another Cold War era and throw them and their allies into yet another vicious arms race.
as United States President Joe Biden keeps failing to honor his campaign promise to quickly undo the damage wrought by his predecessor on relations with Iran, Washington is grappling with the reality that it's now a very different geopolitical world. The just-signed $400 billion, 25-year Iran-China pact, which China's foreign minister called permanent, has been received with shock and awe across the Beltway. Washington's long-standing effort to totally isolate and blockade Iran has formally failed, while China's new ally provides a major energy obstacle to the Pentagon's militaristic pivot to Asia policy.
The foreign policy of the United States really does not change under Democrats or Republicans very much. So there's agreement in that area of the oligarchy on foreign policy. And foreign policy really is based on controlling basically the world.
The Economic and Security Alliance worsens the leverage of the United States, but they have repeatedly undermined their own bargaining position. In 2018, the United States illegally and unilaterally pulled out of the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program and then began reimposing crippling economic sanctions designed to force Iran to renegotiate. Tehran insists compliance with the original pact is the only way forward and reiterated that the deal is still on the table if Biden returns the U.S. into compliance.
What should he do with Iran is he should get back into the agreement that Obama made, and we should be working with them to relieve the sanctions. They've actually done everything that the United States required of them. It's the foreign policy of the United States is totally immoral. So it's immoral towards Iran, as it is in many other places.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani recently said that the lack of knowledge about Iran from American officials is ridiculous. Many analysts have been dumbfounded by the formal alliance. It's what many Americans now call woke, as it's between two nations of different colors, ethnicities, cultures, and cosmologies. Top American media is saying the next few weeks are make or break for the JCPOA, at least until September. The Biden administration is reportedly scrambling to present a new offer to Tehran as soon as next week. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
As the Yemeni army is pushing ahead with its offensive to liberate the city of Marib from Saudi-backed forces, Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held an event in the capital Sana'a to discuss the role of the southern and eastern Yemeni tribes in facing the Saudi-led coalition.
Many of the free people in southern Yemen stand beside their country in groups and parties, but they face severe repression from the forces of the coalition in southern regions, which confirms the ugliness of the crimes committed by the coalition against Yemenis. All Yemenis should be working together on a comprehensive plan to liberate all governorates after the liberation of Marib.
Since the beginning of the Saudi war in Yemen, eastern and western tribes played a key role in supporting the Yemeni army with weapons, money, and fighters. The participants say the tribes devoted their efforts to expel the foreign presence from their country.
The southern and eastern Yemeni tribes have many honorable stances, whether by spreading culture and awareness or supporting the political position inside and outside Yemen. They are also supporting the fronts of confrontation with weapons, men, money, and sending food convoys to the fighters on all fronts. The tribes are seeking to expel the foreign occupation from the country.
The Yemeni army has recently intensified its operations to liberate Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen, a move which is considered as the first step forward for liberating the rest of the country.
Yemenis agree that the liberation of the country will not succeed without the tribes backing the army, since the tribes themselves refuse the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities says the UK system is not rigged against people from ethnic minorities and there is no proof of institutional racism. In a report released Wednesday, it did admit that minorities still face overt racism, but insisted Britain should be regarded as a, quote, model for other white majority countries. The report definitely touched a nerve, suggesting that disparities based on race in the economy and education are negligible. But people here in Brixton definitely disagree.
They live in their little tower and they've grown up in a certain way, but they don't see the reality of what black people are actually going through. So no, there is racism and we are not hung up. We need to just be heard that something is wrong with our bringing up our lives and how we are actually treated, because in reality we are seen as a different colour.
Institutional racism does exist. It exists in the education system everywhere. You can see it in a classroom. A teacher would discriminate against a black student over a white student just because he's black.
The report has been slammed as nonsense that flies in the face of all existing evidence. Flagged up are many issues that black and minority ethnics grapple on a daily basis. For example, the fact that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, and black mothers are 4 times likely to die in childbirth. So is this a genuine effort to understand racism in Britain, or a PR stunt? Many black artists share the view that racism today is alive and well. Junior from the British Collective says his life and career were deeply impacted by racism.
When I was a kid and I was growing up, if I played football and a white guy kicked me, I would have turned around and I might have effed him blind. But it wouldn't have crossed my mind to call him white. Vice versa, the first thing that he would do is turn around and say, "You black so-and-so." Not understanding for himself that he's being racist, he just took it as the norm. It hasn't changed since then. It hasn't changed in any shape, form, or fashion. I hear some politicians trying to turn it into, black politicians trying to turn it into a, oh, well, we've come a long way. We haven't.
The COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate number of deaths among black, Asian, and minority ethnic people clearly illustrate that something is seriously wrong. Being much more likely to have to live in a block of flats and do a job involving a high level of exposure to the public are the sort of factors that critics say prove systemic or structural racism is real. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah, urged Saudi Arabia to immediately end its war on Yemen and lift its blockade on its southern neighbor. Said Nasrallah called on Saudi Arabia not to waste time by proposing deceiving initiatives which lead to nowhere, and stressed that stopping the war and the blockade should be simultaneous. Nasrallah also warned of a Saudi plot to blame Yemen's Ansarullah movement for the ongoing conflict in the war-torn country.
You need to stop the war and end the blockade. Then we can sit and negotiate. Here's where the deception lies. What does it mean if you stop the war without ending the blockade? It means that what they could not realize through a military war, they want to achieve through humanitarian and social pressure.
Elsewhere in his remarks, he said the U.S. is not as strong as before and is on a path toward collapse, while the axis of resistance is gaining power.
America is no longer the America that you knew. There is one main issue that Imam Khamenei has stressed in the last year, and I call on everyone in the region to ponder on that thought. That is the decline of the U.S. America is taking the downward path.
Speaking at an event commemorating late Sheikh Ahmad al-Zin, who was a pioneer in clerics who spoke for Palestine, Nasrallah stressed that the so-called deal of the century has died as a result of the Palestinian people's patience. Observers believe Sayyid Nasrallah's view shows that there is an opportunity for the entire region, even for the Saudis, to be able to stop the crisis of the war they launched on Yemen.
The speech of Sayyid Hassan shows that all regional sides enjoy an opportunity to hold on to their principles and at the same time preserve their achievements. This is true even with the issue of Islamic Republic of Iran and its nuclear program. All of these developments can pave the way for achieving political results.
Hezbollah later also warned regional countries against relying on the United States. Hezbollah's leader then touched upon the political impasse in Lebanon, calling for the immediate formation of a new government. Hezbollah Secretary General has stressed in his speech that most of the wars in the region, namely in Syria or Yemen, are mainly aimed to target the resistance and the Palestinian cause and to create a Sunni-Shiite rift. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهش مند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Witness Donald Williams says he made a 911 call to police to report the police because he believed that he had witnessed a murder. This is from one of the eyewitnesses to the killing of George Floyd, the African-American man killed in Minneapolis by a white police officer, Derek Chauvin, last year. Chauvin put his knee on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 25 seconds while the victim kept saying, "I can't breathe." The Chauvin trial is currently taking place, and Floyd's family is hoping the former policeman will be convicted, but other families whose loved ones have been killed by police in the U.S. say, even with a video, there is no guarantee that a white cop will be convicted of murdering a black man. Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this debate.
The murder trial of Derek Chauvin, a former American cop who knelt on the neck of an unarmed black man for about 9 minutes in Minneapolis last May. Chauvin is charged with the death of that arrested man, George Floyd. The first week of the trial was marked by dramatic and emotional accounts. An eyewitness broke down in tears while responding to prosecutors.
I heard him keep trying to ask them to let him up so he can't breathe. And even I said to the officer, I said, "Man, he said he can't breathe." And man, he said, "Well, if he keeps talking, he can breathe."
Floyd's partner of nearly 3 years also got very emotional while testifying. One of the key moments of the trial was on the fifth day of the proceedings. That's when a senior homicide investigator called Chauvin's use of force on Floyd totally unnecessary.
First of all, pulling him down to the ground, face down, and putting your knee on the neck for that amount of time is just uncalled for.
What level of force might that be?
That would be the top tier, the deadly force.
Why?
Because of the fact that if your knee is on a person's neck, that can kill them.
Many Americans also say Floyd's death has had profound emotional and psychological consequences for them.
It's very traumatic for a black person to follow a trial of a black person who was innocently murdered.
I think it's opened a lot of people's minds to be on the lookout for discrimination.
And so I think that a lot of people, or maybe of my color, have been suffering from that sort of PTSD and trauma.
We also have to have that conversation of what is the role of the police.
One can say that what unites all these people is the trauma of watching the death of a black man under the knee of a white police officer. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to the charges against him. His lawyers argue that Floyd died due to drug overdose. That's why medical examiners have said his death was homicide at the hands of police. The case of George Floyd is undoubtedly a clear example of police injustice and brutality in the United States. His death has already become a symbol of a rallying cry for a global movement against systemic racism and discrimination. But how many other victims are needed for U.S. police to stop abusing their power, especially against minorities in a country known for its racial diversity?
I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate, founder Uhuru Movement, Omaili Yeshitala out of St. Petersburg, Florida, and writer and social justice activist Yandi Indigo out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in St. Petersburg. And Omaili, black Americans are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than whites, and police officers are less likely to be indicted for killing a black person as opposed to others. What exactly does this mean?
It means several things. One thing that it means for sure is that African states constitute a domestic colony, and that Africans in the United States are treated just like colonized people are treated globally. All over the world, you see the same kind of thing, so that even though you may have a particular law that they claim is applicable to everybody equally, the fact is that the colonizer and the colonized have a different relationship to laws that have been created by the colonizer for the purpose of upholding colonialism. And that's why you can see the difference in the number and the percentage of African people police as compared to white people who are the settler colonizers inside the United States. The same would hold true in Israel with Palestinians and with the Israeli citizens, and all over the world you see a similar kind of thing. That's what we're looking at in the United States.
Well, Yane, it appears that when there is a black victim of police violence, there is immediate demonization of the victim, not the accused murderer. Do you agree or not with that? And if so, why is it the case?
Definitely, I agree with that. You can see examples of that. Even when you look at the recent murder, that there was a white man that murdered a bunch of individuals, that in a Chinese hate situation, as it relates to what Brother Omaili spoke about, as the difference between how the colonizers, those who represent the colonizers, are treated compared to those who are amongst part of the colonized communities, that individual was extended a lot of grace. They said he was having a bad day. There was a lot of passion, all this recognition of his humanity. Whereas whenever it's a black victim, the first thing that people attempt to do, and that was with the person who actually was not even a victim, but actually murdered people. But when you're dealing with a black victim, a person who is murdered by the police, one of the first things that they seek to do is find anything they can in order to undermine the character of that individual, and that's ultimately in order to give the both individuals who relate to the state, and particularly within the white community, who play a role of actually like of interceders between the rest of the oppressed class and the colonizing ruling class, Those individuals need excuses in order to be able to continue to stand up for an unjust environment like the militarizing of our communities and the roles that the police play. And so they give them excuses in order to be able to say, see, it was okay. This person was a bad person, and it's not the police aren't bad. The police are victims because they're not being understood as individuals who are having to go up against these really terrible individuals, these terrible entities, even though these are unarmed people, these are people who are not posing any threats. And regardless of whatever happened in their background, they weren't on trial, and it is not the police's right to execute them.
Well, Omali, if we're talking about the U.S., a country that has been built on systemic racism, should there be expectations that justice can be served via the court system?
I think, generally speaking, you cannot achieve justice. The colonized cannot achieve justice through the colonial system. And I think the great fear that the United States is confronted with right now is that, particularly as a consequence of this particular trial, where there and the case of the murder of George Floyd, where millions of people, African people as well as the world, were able to see that murder happen and to collectivize it and to hear the testimony, where every African who listened to another African talk about how helpless they felt and how shame and guilty they feel because they didn't do something, I think there's a growing consciousness among the African population that would take us back to that place where African people had come to understand that the enemy is colonialism and that we cannot achieve any kind of justice under this foreign alien domination of our people, and that we have to fight for power over our own lives. This is the thing that led to J. Edgar Hoover, who has come to be the notorious head of the domestic political police in the United States called the FBI. This is what led him to say that the struggle for black power in the United States as represented by the Black Panther Party was the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. That is because they recognize that this whole rotten social system that murders and brutalizes people all around the world does the same thing in the communities here inside the United States, and that once this people stand up, the whole system stands to be crushed. And I think that's what we're going to see more and more. I think especially after this trial, where each of us had an opportunity to experience the murder of George Floyd as something that, if given an opportunity, we should have done something, would have done something, want to do something, I think you're going to see more direct participation by African people to stop it and to turn it over. That's the struggle against colonialism. That's where we will find our justice.
Yane, we saw mass demonstrations last year across the country after George Floyd's murder. What has happened since then? Has the situation improved for African Americans?
Well, the situation, as is suggested by Chairman O'Malley, the situation is not going to improve for people of African descent here or anywhere in the world until the system is upended. Actually, another example of injustice is Brother Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is incarcerated for a crime that he did not commit. And he wrote a book called Murder Incorporated, and in that book he wrote about the white republic, and he talked about the fact that from the beginning, with the first congressional act of the nation, the Naturalization Act of 1790, it limited nationalization to all free white people, to all free white persons. And so even at that time, and this is the core upon which this nation has been built, that this settler nation has been built, that this has always been a situation where the laws are applied differently depending on who it is that the subject is. So people of African descent are at times able to find individual pieces of justice because there's an effort to sow confusion amongst the various oppressed communities here. But ultimately, nothing about these laws are intended to be with the benefit of any working class people of any race. And so the only way that those who are considered the primary target, the base of the oppression hierarchy, which are black people, are going to find justice is by upending the entire system and living under our own rule and having self-determination.
Well, Omali, the mother of Eric Garner, who was killed by police in New York, while he too was saying he could not breathe, has said that even with the video showing the murder of a black person, it does not equate to the murderer being convicted. Your take on that, and if that happens to be the case this time around, that the former police officer is not convicted, how do you think that that is going to affect? Will we see mass demonstrations again or even more?
Well, first of all, I want to agree with the assumptions that were made by Mother Eric Garner's mother that there is no guarantee, even with video and what have you. And also with the statement that was made by Sister Yanni that the fact is that it's quite possible that given the severity of the condemnation, the how wide the witness of George Floyd's murder, the fact that within 3 months after his murder, there was something like 10,000 demonstrations, protests, and even uprising in the United States, and more than 60 countries around the United States, we saw people protesting his murder, all of whom are responding to a reality not only of George Floyd, but also of the fact that the whole world lives under a form of colonial domination by U.S. and European imperialism and are fighting against that. So it's a possibility that the U.S. government, the state itself, in a way to obscure its responsibility for the colonial domination of African people, would throw George with Derek Chauvin to the wolves. That's some possibility. If they need it, they'll do it in order to obscure the relationship that the state has. That's why you even hear local media, ruling class media here, talk about Chauvin being a former police officer. He wasn't a former police officer when he killed him. He murdered George Floyd as an arm of a domestic colonial state apparatus. And so if necessary to obscure, to protect the state and the colonial relationship that they have, they would definitely allow for and create the conditions for Derek Chauvin to go to trial. And yes, I do anticipate more demonstrations, but I'm telling you that regardless of what the outcome of is in this trial, the situation has changed. Because as opposed to those circumstances where separate and individual communities experience the death and the murder, which happens every day, it's ubiquitous. What happened to George Floyd is not unusual. What's unusual is the masses of people around the world. People had an opportunity. I guarantee what the outcome of this trial.
Okay, stay with me, Amali. Stay with me. I want to get back to that at the end. But let me cross back over to Yanet. Now, there are so many situations and circumstances that black people have been killed by police, it is said, from being black while playing at the park to being black while shopping at Walmart to being black while changing lanes while driving can all end up fatally, as it has for some victims. Explain what this means, especially for our viewers that are less familiar with the reality on the ground in the United States.
What it ultimately means is that as a black person within the United States, you cannot walk around in your life and feel that you are ever safe. You can be sleeping in your bed next to your boyfriend, who then protects you because somebody is breaking into your home, and you can be murdered. You can be sleeping on your sofa, and that was the case of Breonna Taylor. You can be sleeping on your sofa in your grandmother's house at 7 years old and have somebody bust into your house and blow your brains out of your head, which is the case of what happened with Ayanna Stanley Jones. And so there is no ability for a person to walk through and to feel like there's some special thing that you can do. A lot of times people will say, well, you should have just listened to the officer. You should have cooperated. And, you know, and it doesn't really matter what you do. There's actually been video of a person. There was a video of a person who was being confronted with police, and they were giving him the most impossible collection of orders. And this man had to be completely afraid that he was going to be murdered, because there's nothing you can do if you are of African descent being confronted by police in order to guarantee your safety. And it doesn't matter who you are if you are in black skin. And so that is what it means why we say things like driving while black or, you know, shopping while black, because your blackness, it overshadows your humanity in the context of this colonial settler state, this white republic, in which the laws and all of the agents who are, all of the individuals who act as agents of the law are protected in order to move it against you know, move things in the best interest of the ruling class and uphold the status quo.
Oh, Miley, what does all this mean? You've heard what our other guest has just said, and you said that this time around you think it's different. Where is it all going in the United States? Where is this situation going?
I think the depth of crisis inside the United States cannot be overstated. I think the crisis of the entire imperialist social system that's murdering and brutalizing people around the world are concentrated in the United States, which is the shaky hegemon of the whole global colonial capitalist system. I think what we're heading for, with little doubt in my mind, I mean, you look at what's happening on January 6th, the sector of the settler colonists themselves attack the capital of the government of the United States, and then African people, 10,000 uprisings and protests and demonstrations in 3 month period subsequent to the murder of George Floyd inside the United States itself. I think this trial will result in growing numbers of African people reaching revolutionary conclusions, going back to the place where we had achieved revolutionary conclusions before the United States government unleashed a reign of terror that assassinated our leaders and arrested so many people, put in place a prison regime that has resulted in one out of every eight human beings on earth being in prison, being an African in the United States. I think we're going to see the revolution return full of flesh in the United States. And this particular incident with George Floyd is going to prove to be a contribute to that turning point that we're talking about.
All right. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this debate. Founder Uhuru Movement, Omali Yeshitala, out of St. Petersburg, Florida. Writer and social justice activist, Yane Indeko, out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing up for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Are you afraid of snakes? Or spiders? I hope your answer is negative, because today I'm going to visit the spider-tailed horned viper. The spider-tailed horned viper is a unique species of horned viper endemic to western Iran in Ilam province. The species, like other species of horned vipers, have structures above its eyes which gives it a horn-like view. The spider-tailed horned viper has a unique tail that has a bulb-like end that is bordered by long drooping scales that give it the appearance of a spider. The tail tip is waved around and used to lure prey, especially birds. The amazing movements of the tail make it look like a moving spider so that when an animal tries to attack the so-called spider, the poor animal itself becomes the prey in a blink of an eye. I am now in Ilam province, in the habitat of the spider-tailed horned viper. Ilam is located in the heart of Zagros mountain range. 25 beautiful species of snakes, as well as 5 amazing species of vipers inhabit in this region. Among them is the spider-tailed horned viper, which is unique and lesser known to the public, which I've decided to visit it. One of the region's conservation officers had told me that seeing this viper is quite hard and I have to be patient or maybe lucky to spot one. Well, I'm patient for sure, and I hope I'm lucky. Okay, this large stone is an ideal place for them. The spider-tailed horned viper usually lives near these stones. We have to stay silent and motionless. I have to wait. There. This is one of the most amazing scenes I've ever seen in whole of my life. This is not a spider. It's the strange tail of the viper. It's orangish in color. Exactly looks like a spider with its scales around. Well, the spider-tailed horned viper of our story is waiting for a poor, defenseless animal which is after a delicious spider, so that it could trap the animal just with a leap. Tonight, better leave here calmly and don't bother the hunting adventure of this wonderful viper. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning!
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.